everybody.
Welcome to Filmax Radio, episode number 444. That's 444, coming to you on Tuesday, November the 21st of 2017. My Kickstarter is pushing towards the halfway point, and it's a long uphill climb. I need your help. If you hear this, please do go to Kickstarter and search Filmwax and check out the campaign. Check out all that we're trying to do. They're great rewards, and we'll make it there, no doubt about it. But we do need everybody to support, share, tweet about it, whatever you want to do, whatever you can do. It's greatly appreciated. And I'll be forever indebted and grateful to you. And you can contact me through that Kickstarter. You can contact me through Facebook or through the website, filmwaxradio.com. Thank you very much for all your ongoing support and love. Today's guest, one singular guest today on the podcast, Ira Deutschman. Ira Deutschman has been making, marketing, and distributing films since 1975, having worked on over 150 films, including some of the most successful independent films of all time. He was also one of the founders of Cinecon and later created Fine Line Features, two companies that were created from scratch and in their respective times helped define the independent film business. He was also co-founder of Emerging Pictures, the first digital projection network in the United States, and a pioneer of delivering live cultural events into movie theaters. Currently, Deutschman is an independent producer and a consultant in marketing and distribution of independent films. Among his clients are Instituto Luce Cinecittà, for which he promotes Italian cinema in the U.S. He's also a professor of professional practice in the School of the Arts at Columbia University, where we sat and talked. I just have to say that in terms of the films that Ira Deutschman has had his hands on include Jane Campion's An Angel at My Table, Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho, Jarmusch's Night on Earth, Robert Altman's The Player and Shortcuts, Roman Polanski's Bitter Moon and Death and the Maiden, Alan Rudolph's Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle, Mike Leigh's Naked, and the award-winning Hoop Dreams, of course, by our two-time Filmwax guest, Steve James. He's a remarkable person with a remarkable career. We had his son on, who is the VP of acquisitions at Neon. Jeff Deutschman came on a couple of shows back. Proud to bring on the father, since we've had the son, Ira Deutschman, a full hour with one of the great pioneers of independent film right now. No outro, folks. Enjoy the conversation here only, by the way, only on Filmwax Radio. So you're like a great guest because you've been, well, Ira Deutschman, because you've been there since 75. I mean, you've been there through a number of transitions, obviously. And so you would be a great, storyteller for people like that.
Yet to be determined, but you'll let me know okay. When it's over.
Have you done a podcast?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Do you, what's one you did? I'm just curious.
Every year I do one at Sundance.
Oh, very good.
You know, that's, I'm trying to remember who does it, but it's...
Yeah, I've heard about it. Yeah. Is it kind of state of the industry a little oriented?
Yeah, pretty much. Right.
Okay. Well, in this one, I just want to know about, did you go to Hebrew school? Did you... The Ori Bar Mitzvah? What was your... Okay, no. Anyhow, it's great to meet you. I don't think I've met you, so it's really... Your reputation precedes you, and so it's really nice to make your acquaintance finally, and thank you again for doing the podcast.
No problem.
I hope I can do your story justice. Well, we're here actually in your office at Columbia, right? And I actually have my notes on here, but I should be able to remember. I think I have a fair strength or grip on what your background, of course. I guess we could go over a little bit of the past, but I kind of the most interested in your thoughts about what's going on today, you know? And because again, so many people I think that are listening are contemporary filmmakers, you know, and you're helping to produce some of those guys and ladies and right?
Here and there, yes.
How long have you been at Columbia, first of all?
This is my 30th year teaching.
30th?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, so you were... Now I'm guilty, see? So you might have been roughly the same age as some of your older students when you started.
Yeah, actually, I think some of my students were older than I was.
Really?
I still referred to them as kids, but it was obviously a misnomer.
Well, it certainly created the dynamic, you know? If you're trying to be the one who's running the class, you know, it's probably a good idea. But how have the students changed? I'm curious, since you've been here so long and all these years at Columbia, right?
Yep, that's right.
It's fantastic.
How have the students changed? Well, interestingly, there's been different waves of students. It's not like I could look at then and now and say that they're two completely different things. There's been various periods where I've been sort of disappointed with the people who are interested in studying film, and then there's other times where I'm really excited about it. And and I feel like the most disappointing time was kind of an in-between time. You know, part of, for me, the issue that I ran into was people who said that they wanted to be in the movie business in some form, and yet when you talk to them, it sounded like they had never seen a movie. And particularly during the period, I would say in the maybe mid-90s through the early 2000s, it seemed like the earliest movie they'd ever seen was Pulp Fiction, and that the there was no such thing as foreign films or classic films or anything else. And I was just thinking to myself, if you don't have a voracious appetite for actually watching the stuff, then how do you come off even wanting to make it? But I don't think that's true anymore, and I think that what's opened things up is the availability of so many of these movies so easily through various streaming services, et cetera. And I find that even in conversations with students, that if you mention a particular movie referencing it in the context of something I'm talking about in class or even just an offhanded conversation, mm-hmm. then the next time I see them, they've actually seen it.
Yeah, that is... pretty exciting. And what about though the back in those days when you were frustrated, maybe earlier than that? Well, I could see maybe back in a generation or so earlier, there were lots of revival houses, and I don't know, so maybe between that and the VHS, that people were very clued in and watching a lot of stuff. And I wonder, in that medium period, it also though or coming out of that, if there's almost too much ease to it, people have to work so hard to also find films to...
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the big things that's changed industry-wide, yeah. It's not just about the students, but it's about, the entire public, is that because of scarcity, mm-hmm. it meant that film always felt more like an event. And now, because of abundance, it doesn't feel like
there's
that
a mundane
anymore. Mm. Yeah, it's just, you either are a moviegoer or you're not a moviegoer. Most people are out of the habit. When they go to the movies, they, for the most part, have a good experience and they want more. And that's exactly what we need to be fostering. But when I was a kid growing up, if there was a revival of some movie at a local repertory cinema, I knew that I had to get out and see the movie because
right.
the opportunity to see that movie was that night, or you might have to wait six months
again.
Year,
sure.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas that just doesn't exist anymore.
Right. As a matter of fact, where did you grow up, since you mentioned it?
That's complicated.
Okay.
Originally,
the best questions are.
I was born in North Carolina.
Okay.
I then lived in the Bronx for a while. Then I spent what I considered to be my formative years in Chicago.
Oh.
But I've been living my entire adult life in New York. So.
Well, I know, because you've been teaching here for 30 years.
Yes.
What were the circumstances, if I may ask, about moving so much in your formative years?
It was all about my dad's
parents' jobs. Yeah. Okay. And so were your parents big film watchers? Because when did the bug hit pretty young? So you were already in school and you were already distributing films, right?
Yeah, I think they kindled it. Mm-hmm. My dad was on the road a lot. In the earliest years that I can remember going to the movies, I was my mother's date. And I do think that she used to bring me to some stuff that was maybe not so appropriate for somebody
right.
my age. And then later on, we used to go as a family to the drive-in, and that also it was interesting because in those days, you went to the drive-in, and they would usually have an early show of a family-friendly movie, and then the idea was that we were supposed to go to sleep in the back seat, and then the adult film would come on, and my parents would get to watch that, but my parents never realized I was not asleep. I was watching those movies, too.
Yeah.
But I think that it really caught fire in a confluence of things in the late 60s. It was when my family had just moved from Chicago to New York. And it was in the middle of high school, and I was really upset with them, and I didn't have any friends. And so I spent a lot of time at the movies, which was a thing to do.
Here?
It was in New Jersey, technically. Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
where you were in, like, Secaucus or something?
Paramus.
I'm sorry. That's difficult.
It's not the easiest place to spend high school. The confluence, the other part of it was that just happened to be the moment when Hollywood was more or less in its prime and heading toward its classic years. And so I just saw all these movies that just kind of blew me away. And it wasn't like I made up my mind at that point that I wanted to be in the film business, but I knew that I wanted to be in media somehow. I knew that I wanted to be involved with storytelling somehow. And it didn't really manifest itself until I was in college back at Northwestern, when I had two different things going on that sort of pointed me toward film as being my calling, as it were. The first being that I got involved with several film societies and started programming films. And I had a work study job as a projectionist, which, you know, kind of got me hands on a little bit with it. But the other thing is that my major was radio, TV, film. And I didn't really have a preference when I walked into the program, but by the time I was finished, I realized that television was not for me because I had a disastrous experience trying to do a live TV show that turned into just not a very watchable thing. And then radio just struck me as being kind of dull. But I really took to the process of making films, and then the rest, I guess, was history.
You were saying those years of escaping into the movies was late 60s, which was certainly an incredible period between Easy Rider, Bonnie and Clyde,
Bonnie and Clyde was a transformative movie for me. I must have seen it like 15 times while it was still in the movie theaters. That sounds ridiculous in this day and age, but I saw it 15 times over probably 20 weeks because it was playing in the same theater for 20 weeks.
Yeah, so most people may not be aware that a hit could run in a theater in New York, well, in a city, for easily 6 months, if not a year. It could actually come back again, maybe for whatever consideration, or just because it was just doing so well.
Right.
That the theater might even bring it back again for a second run, and it just did gangbusters. So that first real example was Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, that was the movie, I think, that really lit a fire in terms of how powerful movies could be. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think I understood it entirely when
like
I was
seeing it. Like the homoerotic or the sexual undertones,
that's exactly what I was thinking of when I made that point. It was years later when I saw the film sort of understood what was going on in that scene.
It wasn't I used the wrong expression. It was sort of suppressed homosexual feelings. It wasn't homoerotic in the sense Faye Dunaway, she is the most desirable woman on screen.
I don't have to describe it in detail.
Yeah. I'm just now getting distracted by remembering Faye Dunaway in those films. Yeah, that was a real big deal, that film, right? It was one of those...
Most people point to Bonnie and Clyde as being the beginnings of the acknowledgement of the new Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, even though there were things that happened before Bonnie and Clyde that probably would have been harbingers, it was the moment where it kind of exploded.
Yeah. Yeah, and there were some independent-minded filmmakers out there already for some time, but hadn't, you know, they hadn't quite created the traction that movie and maybe Easy Rider just for some reason really caught on in a bigger, you know, way in their day. So yeah, and then of course the 70s. So you know, that sort of describes that whole period of films. That I mean, your students must constantly. They all seem to get turned on by the 70s, right? Still to this
yeah.
day?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think that their knowledge of the 70s goes as deep as it might.
Uh-huh.
You know, they just did this retrospective at the Film Society of Lincoln Center called 1977.
Oh, right. Yeah. They took 1 year and they made, it was quite a cross section. It wasn't.
Oh, it was incredibly eclectic.
Yeah.
I mean, I just was so blown away by their choices. And, you know, not necessarily that I would have made the same choices, mm-hmm. but just simply that they were paying attention to so much. And if there was any criticism that I would have at all of that particular series, it was just that the smattering of foreign films that were included were just a smattering. And so in a way, the foreign films were underrepresented in mm-hmm. terms of what was going on during that period. And it may have made more sense to limit it to American films.
I see.
And you know, sort of separate it out.
Sure, yeah.
But that's a minor nitpick. I mean, my feeling is that, that it was definitely a great cross-section of the, you know, the breadth of cinema at that time.
Yeah. Right. Jaws would have just been considered another major game changer at that time, right?
Well, yeah, but that was, I mean, that's more from a business perspective.
Yeah, that's true. Speaking of which, though, I really am interested. You made a remark before just about the waves of the students, where they're at, the zeitgeist of the film classroom. Do you think now, well, let me just ask you and not feed you the words, the tension between the art and the business. I know years ago students wouldn't have been talking about distribution. I don't know if it's even taught here, if it's part of your curriculum.
That is what I teach.
My
very first course at Columbia was literally called Marketing and Distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And that course has evolved over the years, but a version of that course has been taught continuously for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's now called The Business of Film. But we've had that woven into the curriculum as far back as I go. And it was that course was taught even before I taught it. Mm-hmm. I was brought in to take the place of somebody else who taught it before me.
Really?
Yeah. So I have no idea whether other schools were doing it as far back as that, but I do know that our students have benefited from it. I've talked to alums who have been out of the program for decades, who, you know, talk about things that we discussed in class and who feel like those lessons were really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't ever want to stifle the creativity of filmmakers by, you know, slapping them around with marketplace realities. But a little bit of that goes a long way in terms of just understanding that you can't have it both ways. If you really want your films to be seen, then you have to understand the marketplace around it. You can't, it just doesn't exist in an isolated way. Maybe it does if you're an experimental filmmaker and all you aspire to is to be shown in museums,
mm-hmm.
You know, which is perfectly fine, no value judgment on my part. Or if you're a foreign filmmaker and can survive on government grants, which of course is not something that's available to Americans. So if you don't have those type of connections or aspirations, then as an American filmmaker, or any filmmaker who aspires to exist in the American market,
mm-hmm.
you have no choice but to at least be somewhat cognizant of what sells.
And do the students have the choice, or is this a required course?
It's required for the producing students, and it's...
That makes sense.
Yeah, and it's an elective for the writers and directors.
And what are the general trends in that? I mean, do you find that a lot of the students are compelled to take the class? Because it makes sense. I mean,
it's on the upswing.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, we require the producers to do it, so it's like mm-hmm. that's a given. But back when I first started, the entire department was much smaller, and there were way less courses being offered. And at that time, I got the sense that, you know, 70 or 80% of all the students in the department took the course. That would not be true anymore. We're way bigger. There's way too many choices. And their heads are full of all sorts of other things. So actually what's interesting is that the writers and directors, writing and directing students, I should say, who take the class, I find are incredibly serious. And so it's sort of natural selection in a way.
Mm-hmm. Are they pretty prepared by the time, even, you know, and knowledgeable before they even come into the classroom?
Some of them are.
There's so much just information and also literature, which is another dimension to it, than there used to be, of course. Like in the last 10, 20 years, the New York Times, since they started reporting not only weekend grosses and that type of thing, and some of the trades became kind of more mainstream reading for people, right? And there's a whole sort of industry around books about the business. So I just would imagine that very ambitious students would probably already come in with a certain amount of,
I think information. Not as much as you would think. The fact is that most of what is available in mainstream media is incredibly superficial. And I have to say that when I'm flipping through newspapers, magazines, even the trades, looking for articles that I think might be of interest to the class when I'm teaching it, I sometimes get snagged by a headline and I go, oh, this could be really interesting. And then I read the article and it's like, no, it's really not all that interesting.
Yeah.
So, I don't think that there's that much good journalism going on. Every once in a while, you read something where you go, okay, well, this person really got it. But particularly the mainstream publications, by the time they see it as a story, usually it's already ending.
It's a postmortem.
I mean, if it's hit their radar screen, then the likelihood is that it's not news anymore.
Yeah, right. I understand. So when you started, not to pop around too much, but it reminds me of what I've read about you, and it's I think in your profile on the Columbia University site that you were. Even in college, you were already interested in distribution, or you were working?
Well, I was involved with what was called the Activities and Organizations Board, the A&O Board at Northwestern.
Okay.
I started out just assisting with a couple of projects. Then one year, I became the head of the film programming, and I oversaw several film series, but the one that I actually programmed myself was called Midnight Madness. It was mostly, what you would expect to be midnight movies.
Genre films, that kind of thing?
Midnight movies were just really offbeat.
Yeah.
It was not as confined as nowadays when people think of midnight movies as being horror or genre films, or
dark comedies. It was mostly
like strange counterculture movies. It could be anything from Midnight, Reefer Madness to John Waters movie, or Putney Swope, or things like that.
Yeah. And underground films, kind of understand.
So in any case, and then by my third year that I was involved with the A&O board, I was running the entire A&O board. And that year, I got a phone call out of the blue from somebody who worked for John Cassavetes, who was working with him to distribute A Woman Under the Influence. And they had come up with this plan where they were going to use college campuses essentially to be their marketing machines to get the word out about the movie. And so they were interested in having us host what would be the Midwest premiere of A Woman Under the Influence.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And
it's a musical comedy, I believe.
Yes.
Starring Jenna Rollins.
So I jumped at the opportunity. We did it in Kahn Auditorium, which, if I'm remembering correctly, is something like 800 seats. Might even be more than that.
Decent acoustics.
We sold the place out. John Cassavetes was there. Jenna Rollins was there. Peter Falk was there.
Wow.
Gazzara was there.
Amazing.
And it was my first taste of kind of the professional film distribution business. Not that I did that much, but, the whole point was that I helped to promote it on campus to get butts in seats. I got to introduce them, got to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually late in my senior year that we did that.
How do you top that? Has it all been downhill since then?
Well, yeah, the next step is actually to try to make money at it.
Well, there's that, but I'm just thinking about, as far as events go, there's this incredible Q&A or introduction and Q&A, and how do you ever get better than that? Jenna Rollins and John Cassavetes, Ben Gazzara. Anyway.
I didn't know enough to think about the fact that it
was probably
the height of my life.
So wait, so Cassavetes was working with somebody, you're saying, who had this idea of introducing it to...
Yeah, I don't know whose idea it was exactly, but it was his company. Cassavetes self-released the film.
Right, so, right. Yeah. Sure, sure. And then how long until you were... Because I can't imagine that people thought this was a job when you were coming out of... unless you were going to Hollywood.
Yeah, well, I was pretty naive. I was... it's funny. I sent my resume and a cover letter to all of the major studios and to their offices in both New York and Los Angeles without knowing a soul. And the only thing I got out of the experience was a lot of really cool letterhead that with the rejection letters. Because, you know, the Disney one had Mickey Mouse on it and Paramount one had their logo on it. And
This is
nice collector's items.
You still have those?
Actually, the University of Michigan has them now. Oh. They're part of my archive.
So, okay. Very good.
But in any case...
For those in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, that's the one. Mm-hmm. Right?
So you naively letters, sent out your
pitch. So then it turned out that, when I got all those negative responses, I was debating, you know, there were clearly no jobs in Chicago for me. But I did have some contacts in the non-theatrical world, having, you know, been booking movies from various companies. And so I made the choice, rather than go to Los Angeles, where I really didn't know much of anybody, I ended up going to New York. It helped that my parents were still living in New Jersey, so I had a place. I actually had a physical place to go. Mm-hmm. And I started applying for jobs. And one of the places I went to was Faces International, which is the company that was Cassavetes' company that I had just worked with on the premiere of Woman Under the Influence. And Blaine Novak, who was my contact there, took a meeting with me, and he said, coincidentally, I just got this phone call today from Ruth Robbins, who works at Cinema 5, and they're looking for a non-theatrical salesperson. And he said, you know, let me call her up right now. Maybe you could run over there, because they were only a few blocks away. So he picks up the phone, calls Ruth, gets back on the phone with me. Turns back to me in the meeting, and says, well, Ruth said, come on right over. So I ran the several
grabbed
blocks.
All your rejection letters.
Yeah, right. ran the several blocks to the meeting. Uh-huh. Had a meeting with Ruth, and thus began my Don Rugoff Cinema 5 adventure, which really got me started in the distribution business.
Oh, so you're saying for those listening, non-theatrical. So these are educational.
It's the big customers in those days were college campuses, college film societies, but we were also renting to high schools and classroom use and libraries,
institutional
prisons,
distribution, right?
Parks departments,
Sure, sure. Yeah. So we're an organization, that's not a theater.
And what's interesting is that it was a fairly big business at that time because it was
It's relatively
video.
Still.
No.
Compared to. Well, I don't want to change the subject on you, but maybe we can go back to that.
But, this was pre-home video, and what we were renting was 16mm prints. Mm-hmm. I could sometimes get, when I was working on a film like Monty Python and the Holy Grail, I could get $1,000 from colleges as a guarantee for a single screening of a movie, which would be unbelievable. It doesn't happen anymore, trust me.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to think of what that educational... I know it's the institution, not the...
Yeah, libraries would take out long-term leases. That would be a big sale. We would have a $5,000 sale for a 10-year lease with one 16mm print.
Amazing. Know? Right? And nobody was complaining about the shape of the print, over time either, because they weren't spoiled on whatever future media would end up replacing the 16mm reel. But I guess I just meant I made a documentary. I can't barely get a theatrical out of it. So educational is, I'm just in that relative sphere. I'm just thinking, or within that, realm, educational can actually make me my money, and I can pay back investors based on
it. It's just that for certain kinds of movies where libraries would think that it's a must have. then you can get away with fairly good prices. And when I say fairly good prices, it could be in the hundreds of dollars or something, as opposed to the thousands of dollars that it used to be. But for the average movie, you know, because of the first sale doctrine and because of the you know, the low price of home video these days, it's really hard to get anything more than what you would get for the wholesale price of a DVD.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, so that started that. And then what was next?
Well, Cinema 5 became this transformative experience for me because I worked for, I mean, I skipped over a little piece of the story, which you might find amusing. You know, I was familiar with the Cinema 5 company for a couple of reasons, one of which was that while I was in those formative years in high school going to all those movies, a lot of the movies I went to were at the local art house, and which was the Bergen Mall Cinema in Paramus. And a lot of the movies that I went to see were Cinema 5 movies, things like Trash and, as I mentioned before, Putney Swope or Marjo or Gimme Shelter or, you know, I mean, all these really bizarre but sort of intriguing movies that were appealing to the kind of person that I was becoming.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
I was sort of getting into my counterculture phase, and these movies were feeding into it. So I was familiar with this library of movies. When I was programming Midnight Madness at Northwestern, I was booking a lot of those movies. Mm-hmm. So clearly they had inspired me in some way. So I was familiar with the company and I was familiar with their films. And then also during that high school period, I was driving into Manhattan a lot with you know, whatever few friends I could pick up and going to the Cinema 5 theaters, which were on 3rd Avenue, Cinema 1, Cinema 2, the Sutton,
right,
the Beekman, the Murrell, the Plaza, the Paris.
All surrounding Alexander's. And
yes, yes. Well, they like Bloomingdale's. To say Bloomingdale's.
Yeah, no, I know. well, it survived.
Yes. But in any case, so I was very familiar with the company and its reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And the day that I went into do that interview, I was actually pretty excited about it because if there was a company that I really would want to work for, it would be them. So Ruth interviewed me for about 15 or 20 minutes, asking me a bunch of questions about movies I'd seen. And of course, as a fan, I had plenty of answers. And then she asked me to go. She said, okay, so I want you to meet Mr. Rugoff. And I was the first time I ever heard that name. I mean, but it turns out Rugoff was the guy who ran the company and had been running the company for as long as I was familiar with it. So she asked me to sit out in the hallway, in the reception area, and that she was going to let Mr. Rugoff know that I was going to meet with him. So I sat there and I sat there and I sat there, and it was now after 6 o'clock, and it seemed like everybody else in the office had left. And I'm wondering, when the hell am I ever going to meet this guy?
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly this person shows up, shuffling down the hall. He, you know, his shirt tail was hanging out, his zipper was open, his hair was disheveled.
It's like a homeless guy walking around the offices.
That's exactly what it looked like. And in fact, my first impression, particularly given the fact that it was after 6 o'clock, was that maybe this was the janitor. And he says to me, follow me. So I follow him down the hall, and I head into this corner office, and that was the moment when I realized that was Mr. Rugoff.
Yeah.
And so my adventure there began on that day. He interviewed me for about 15, 20 minutes, and then when the interview ended, he said to me, your parents should be very proud. You start on Monday. That was the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I started on Monday, and I worked there for 3 years. During the course of that 3 years, I went from non-theatrical sales to theatrical sales to co-op advertising, and then I spent the last year there working in acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned just about everything I know about the film business from that experience, about exhibition, about marketing, about distribution.
Those 3 years were school.
Exactly. Yeah. And by the way, if you know, people use the term school of hard knocks a lot, and there's many different types of schools of hard knocks, but Rugoff was a very, very difficult boss.
Oh, he was. Because it almost sounded like you were setting it up for the curmudgeonly, offbeat, but in the end, the lovable.
There were things that
man who ended up like inspiring you in your career.
There were things that were lovable about him, sort of. but he treated his employees really badly.
Oh yeah,
demanded a lot of us, which made it a different kind of learning experience. You know, you were, but he always. I mean, the thing is, he would give you enough rope to hang yourself, and then of course would hang you. But the thing is that he gave you that rope so mm-hmm. that you had enormous responsibilities for a young person. You know, no matter what your job description, he would call you into his office, or maybe you happened to be in his office when something dawned on him or an idea came up or a phone call came in, and he would just send you on some sort of mission that had nothing to do with your job.
Right.
And by the way, you had no idea what you were doing,
yeah.
but you had to perform because
right.
otherwise you'd get chewed out and,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
Fired, although he would forget that he did that.
Oh, really?
Yes.
They just come back the following Monday.
Yeah, I mean, I know people who were fired, and then he would call them up the next day and say, "Where the hell are you?"
And it makes sense not to remind him that you were fired. Just show back, come back and continue. That's funny.
So happens, by the way, that not that I'm trying to plug anything.
No, please.
But I'm actually making a documentary about him.
You are?
Yeah.
Oh, is that right? What stage are you at the moment?
It's about 95, maybe 98% shot.
Uh-huh. Now, he's not alive.
No.
Okay.
He died in 1989.
Oh, quite some time back. So
yes.
Are you using photos? I mean, what's there?
Well, it's a good question. I
reenactments.
Yes, that will not happen. I'm interviewing people who worked with him, for him,
mm-hmm.
filmmakers whose films he distributed, competitors back in the day. You know, it's basically
right.
people telling their stories.
It's mostly talking head, of course, and then
clips from the movies.
And is this a feature?
I hope it's going to be a feature.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And when was the last time you made a film?
Well, you mean as a director?
Well, it sounds like you're the director of this,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, that's why I asked the question.
So is this a first?
Since college.
Is that right?
Yeah, I haven't directed a film since college.
That's nice.
I produced a lot of movies
right.
in between.
Yeah. Yeah, some of which. Well, I have to say at this stage, well, first of all, so were you, Cinema 5?
Yes.
Right. Were they distributing the films they acquired beyond the Upper East Side?
Yep. They were.
Okay.
I mean, they
were there like
out,
those theaters in other cities as well?
They started out as a theater chain.
Okay.
And actually the theater chain started like in the 1930s.
Uh-huh.
Rugoff inherited the theater chain in the 50s. Completely reconfigured the company, which had been a chain of neighborhood theaters, mostly mm-hmm. in the outer boroughs, and focused on Manhattan. Built,
I see.
You know, his father began the building of the Beekman before his father passed away. But then he actually constructed Cinema 1 and 2, and then started taking over other theaters like the Paris and the Plaza and the Sutton and others.
Oh, so they had the Paris.
And then over time, the theater chain became this amazing powerhouse theater chain. And then he decided to get into distribution. And
mm-hmm.
so he started distributing films in the early 60s. And he was distributing films all through the 60s and all through the 70s. And then he was kicked out of the company in 1979.
I'll wait for the film.
Yes.
Don't give it away.
Yeah, well, I won't give it away.
Well, it's good. I already know you're going to come back on when the film's ready to
all right
theatrically debut. I hope. And wow, that's a great story. And it's like, yeah. I mean, you're just had this great opportunity to kind of get the whole gamut of things. So from there, did you start your own company after that? Or?
No, I still had it in my mind that I was going to be a quote-unquote filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And all through the period that I was working at Cinema 5, I had this idea for a screenplay in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the first opportunity after I was gone from the company, I started writing it. And I spent 2 years... making money by doing some freelance writing and then working on this screenplay. It was a stupid comedy in a Cheech and Chong kind of vein, believe it or not. called Loose Joints, mm-hmm. and it's still available if you're interested.
I am. sure. Absolutely. Yes. So who directed it?
Nobody. Oh, still available, meaning the screenplay.
The screenplay is still available. Yes. Oh, for that's funny. Okay. I'm sure it will
and
get
it
made.
It never made any of the Hollywood best unproduced screenplay lists.
Oh, what do they call the
blacklist?
Blacklist, yeah. Yeah, but you know, and then
So then mm-hmm. I spent 2 years doing that. Uh-huh. Then I ran out of money. Right. Decided that I better get a job.
You don't want to have to move back to Paramus.
I had been, I had been doing some freelance writing for United Artists, uh-huh. rewriting their non-theatrical catalog, which was my practice for Twitter. I had to write very short synopses of mm-hmm. over 1,000 movies. Mm-hmm. By the way, I didn't have to watch all of them. That would have taken me the rest of my life.
Sure.
But just sort of reworking it to make them punchier and, you know, whatever. And so I had kind of a foot in the door there. And then they decided that they were going to start this division called United Artists Classics. And I became one of their first employees. Myself, along with Tom Bernard, and
who would later go on to Sony Classics.
That's right. Yeah. So Tom and I, Tom ran sales, I ran marketing, and then mm-hmm. Donna Giolotti joined us as the head of acquisitions. We reported to a guy by the name of Nathaniel T. Quitt Jr., who was United Artists' senior vice president of special projects, I think is what it was called.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was really the beginnings of the modern classics division. The classics division
right.
itself had uh-huh. existed already,
uh-huh.
And had actually released some foreign language movies, some older foreign language movies, as first run movies in the United States. So the idea wasn't totally new, but the difference was that under Than Quitt's direction, we actually started getting aggressive in buying mm-hmm. foreign language films to release in the United States.
Were these what year roughly are we talking about when
this would have been it couldn't have been late 79. It would have been 1980.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I'm just trying to think of some of the titles that would have been coming out.
The very first film that we released was The Last Metro, the Fred
sure.
Truffaut film.
With Catherine Deneuve and Gerard Depardieu, I think, was in it.
And then we ended up uh-huh. doing his next film, which was called The Woman Next Door. We ended up doing re-releases of things like the movie that was originally called Cutter and Bone. And re-released it
John
as Cutter's
Hurt.
Way.
Yeah. So you're partly responsible for that. I'm just wondering, was it the title? What happened? It's kind of one of these classics getting found by a new generation. And then with John Hurt recently dying, I know it's come up again as a kind of one of these lesser known
favorites. It's a great example of something that I talk about all the time about how expectations are part of the potential success or failure of a film. And in that case,
it was made as a
studio movie.
Okay.
You know, United Artists, the parent company, made the uh-huh. movie. They hired a Czech director, to direct it. Nobody had ever heard of John Hurd. Jeff Bridges was, he was somewhat well known. It was, you know, after he'd already been in.
Well, he'd been in a famous family.
Yeah,
also.
But
he'd already done the last picture show.
And it was
he's a child actor.
And it was also a relatively low budget film. So, you know, UA probably made the movie thinking there was not that much to lose. They saw the movie when it was finished. They clearly thought it was a total loss, that there was nobody put any thought into how to market it or what to do with it.
Yeah.
The title was a problem, at least in my opinion, even though it was based on a book called Cutter and Bone. So I think it was one of the reasons why they thought they were tied to the title.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it just was very unappetizing. It just sounded like it was going to be about surgery or something, you know?
Mm. And, the word cut and bone in the same title.
Yeah,
I could see it as being a little.
Yeah.
So it changed to Cutter's Way?
Well, yeah. So we end up they released the movie just in New York, I think, in a number of theaters.
Yeah.
It completely died.
Yeah.
And then they put it on the shelf.
And as then, Cutter and still as Cutter and Bone?
Yeah, I mean, they literally just threw it away.
Right.
And then I don't know whether, you know, Than Quitt came to us with it or whether, you know, I don't know where the actual idea came from. But we just looked at it and said, you know, this movie's better than that. This movie really is an art film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe the kinds of things that we were doing with these foreign language films would be a way to handle it. And so we, you know, sat around and batted around ideas in marketing meetings, et cetera, came up with the new title, Cutter's Way, which at least made it clear that Cutter was a person, you know, as sort opposed of. To an occupation.
yeah, right.
And you know, the poster was a collaboration with a woman by the name of Linda Stanger, who was like a freelance artist that I'd been using for a lot of campaigns. And, you know, it was a duotone photograph of the two of them together, you know, with
the
patch on his eye. And, you know, very weird looking thing. And we decided that we were going to try to open up the film in Boston, where the film had never opened in its original incarnation. Opened at the Orson Welles, and the reviews were just incredible. You know, it just it was approached a completely different way. And the film was a hit. I mean, it was like setting house records in Boston.
Really?
And so we brought it back in New York under the new title, and it became like a story, the fact that we were reviving this movie that, you know, that UA had thrown away. And then it kind of went to our heads, and we decided to keep doing that with other UA flops.
right. You thought you put onto something that nobody else ever figured out.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Is there one other example of that I'm not aware of? Did you actually change the title on another film?
Or? No, we didn't change the title. Well, actually, yes, we did. Because
there could be a small retrospective of films where the titles were changed.
Yeah, well, we re-released Joan Micklin Silver's, what was originally released as Head Over Heels.
Head Over Heels. Well, she directed John Hurd, actually, in an earlier film.
Yes.
Called...
what was the title again?
Something
Between the Lines.
Chilly Scenes of Winter.
Well, that is the one I'm talking about.
It
Chilly
is?
Scenes of Winter.
Oh, that's
Head
funny.
Over Heels became Chilly Scenes of Winter
when we re-released it. Oh, in that case, you actually did the reverse where you went back to the original book's title?
That's correct.
That's funny. It's such a great title.
Yep. And
unlike Cutter and Bone, I could see that
as... I don't know why they were afraid of the title.
So did that come out after Cutter's Bone?
Yeah.
Cutter and Bone? Or
there had been,
Way?
I think, 3 years between the original release.
So he really was not known.
Head Over Heels.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Because he was a leading man in that one. I mean, an anti-hero, but he was still
the lead. He'd already been in one Joan Micklin Silver film before that, Between the Lines, which was his first film.
Okay, yes. I think the Quad recently showed that, and I was trying to get over there. And she, and Silver, she just was at, like, last night, actually, at the film forum with...
Hester Street?
No, Crossing Delancey.
Oh, Crossing
she's quite
Delancey.
One of these filmmakers that really has been ignored. Maybe partly because she's just, you know, not interested in that amount of attention. I wouldn't know, but
I wouldn't. I wouldn't say ignored as much as forgotten. I mean,
yeah, that's a better word.
Because the fact is that,
that really
she was
films.
A big deal for a long time.
Okay.
As the first woman,
right.
Independent director, truly
right.
independent director.
Yeah.
You know, and she and her husband were quite the team where he produced her films. And then in
who's her husband?
Ray Silver.
Okay.
And you know, he raised the financing independently in a way, set the stage for the way that independent film financing is structured.
Yeah.
And then he ended up releasing some of those movies himself.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, given what we've been talking about, when Ray released Hester Street, which was Joan's first feature, he hired all the people who had just worked on Woman Under the Influence for Cassavetes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah. Come full circle here.
Right. Yeah. So I have you to largely thank. I mean, I know then you go on to,
yeah,
I'm going to say Klein Lines.
Then was Cinecom.
Cinecom. That's right.
Yeah. Which I started with a couple of partners. That was my first time completely independent as a so-called entrepreneur.
Yeah. But still ahead of the curve a little bit, right? Weren't you still? You were taking art house films still, weren't you?
Yeah. What was interesting is that all through this, you know, like if we go through my chronology and all the various jobs I've had, et cetera, it might look to people like I was always ahead of the curve. But in fact, the way you become ahead of the curve is by running away from what everybody else is doing. You know, in other words, try to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Cinecom, the original business plan was that we were going to do foreign language films in the United States. But by the time the company got started, there were so many classics divisions that were at that point copying what UA Classics was doing that the prices for foreign language films were getting bid astronomically high. And there was no way to make money, especially as an independent company that didn't have a parent company behind us with, you know, billions of dollars that, you know, were, you mm-hmm. know, hide our ups and downs. The fact is that it just didn't make sense for us to bid against all those classics divisions.
Right. Well, the classic divisions, in other words, had it jump in because yeah. I'm going to probably do a poor job. But it for a guy like you or like a small independent, a truly independent company, which doesn't have a parent studio company with the money, it takes a couple of years at least to recover financially on a film, right? To kind of get the money back, right?
Most of the time.
And then you can
yeah.
refeed
and by the
into
way, some of them you know,
are losing. Right, exactly. Yeah. So
and particularly
it's not like there's anybody who can shuffle the money over to you. And
right. right? And where there's bidding wars on movies, people get crazy. They pay way too much money for these films.
Yeah, it's like an auction house in that sense where it's just there's a momentum and an excitement
right.
and then buyer's remorse.
So you know, when we realized that was going on, yeah. we, you know, made a conscious decision that rather than go there mm-hmm. and have to compete with what were studio divisions, that instead we would focus on this thing that people were just beginning to talk about, this, you know, American independent thing.
Yeah.
And you know, what was happening was that there was this little bubbling up of, you know, very low budget movies that were being made mostly in and around New York, but in other parts of the country as well. It was just becoming a thing that people were beginning to talk about. And nobody had, even though Cassavetes, you can argue, was the grandfather, forefather of American
John Sayles.
Film. But John Sayles was really when the term started being used.
Okay.
Nobody referred to it as American independence until those early years of, you know, John Sayles is a perfect example. So what happened was we said to ourselves, you know what, if we focus on this, which nobody else is really paying attention to, and we use the same techniques that we would have used to release a foreign language film, handle it as an art film, and we'd had a little bit of a taste of that at UA with those re-releases mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. like things like Cutter's Way, maybe this is a business plan. And we got lucky in two ways. The first film we released was Robert Altman's Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, which turned out to be, you know, it made a few million dollars, which, you know, was, given the fact that we paid nothing for it, was really great.
Based on his reputation for his earlier seminal
It was based on really good reviews and mm-hmm. Cher being in it.
Cher was huge.
And just, it was really a comeback film for him. He had had a fallow period of a good, you know, it felt like 10, 12 years, but it was probably only 4 or 5.
Yeah.
But he had a fallow period where nothing was making money that he was
wasn't
involved with.
But it was still one of those, in those years that you're describing of his career, that was like he was taking plays, essentially.
Well,
and reworking
the
them.
Yeah,
this was before the Nixon
yep,
personal
afterwards.
Whatever. So yeah. I can't remember the name, but
it was called Honor.
Personal Affair. Honor. Yes, Secret Honor.
Secret Honor. Thank you.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. That's right.
Good. Yeah, we ended up releasing that movie too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we started out with a bang because that film, you know, was a bit of a hit, and then what really got us lucky was the fact that we were focusing on English language movies, and just then was when the home video boom started, and the home video companies did not want foreign language films. They only wanted English language films. And so suddenly we were just rolling in money because all that money was available. You know, all the major studios needed more product than they could handle, mm-hmm. than their studio divisions could handle. And so we became a target for all these home video companies that were essentially financing the company so that we could do these releases and they would get the VHS rights.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a string of hits. It was pretty successful. We, you know, the among the more successful movies were The Brother from Another Planet and El Norte and Stop Making Sense. And then our biggest hit of all was A Room with a View.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I know. I have you guys to thank for that's when I was discovering. I mean, I grew up in a house also where my parents were really into foreign films and art films. So I had that advantage. I grew up in New York, so albeit in Forest Hills. But my parents were very into those filmmakers like Fellini, Antonioni, you name it, Kurosawa. And so that was always going on in the house. So by the time I discovered film as a young guy going to college, and that's exactly the period when I discovered it. And I was actually going to school in Boston. There were so many great movie houses, and they were all playing these films in those days. It was like early to mid 80s, and it was just everything. And they bring back Hitchcock films that had been lost in a legal morass for years. All of a sudden they came back. It was just this amazing, amazing period of time, for the art house, And then there were revival houses were still big, so you could just go see anything, and it was all cheap.
All true.
Yeah. Thank you. In other words, so it's nice to be able to meet one of the people that were responsible for putting those movies in front of me. And Stop Making Sense had an enormous impact.
Yeah, I just saw it again this summer. A lot of art houses across the country showed it again this summer in honor
of Jonathan Demme. Yeah.
And I saw it in Traverse City, Michigan, outdoors, right at the shores of Lake Michigan.
You mean just recently?
Yeah.
At the Traverse City Festival? At the festival in September, yeah.
Boy, it was so much fun seeing it again with a group of really enthusiastic people who didn't stop dancing through
the
entire thing.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. Even, I made my parents go to see it when I was back. I came back, to New York, and it was still in theaters, And I made them go. I didn't have to work very hard. They really respected my taste in movies, too. So they knew that they had a progeny with that. So anyway, I remember my parents, they were really enjoying it. My mom, I remember she got up at one point because people were literally dancing in the aisles during those screenings, right? When has that happened again? Have you seen it? I've never seen it since. Never seen it.
I mean, maybe it has. Maybe I'm just not going to movies anymore.
What kind of movies are you? Are you still interested in going to the movies?
I go to the movies all the time.
You do? Did you go to see Mother?
No. Horror is not my genre.
I don't think of it as horror, by the way, but go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I'm maybe now that I've read more about it, I'm perhaps a little bit more interested in it than I was. But yeah, no, I just got back from the Toronto Film Festival. I saw 15 movies in 4 days, and I'm sort of stocked up. When I go to the film festivals, I feel like a squirrel, like stuffing food in my cheeks and getting ready for the winter. It's like
I understand. Did you see anything at Toronto that was especially memorable?
My two favorite movies there. One of them was the Louis C.K. movie. Which I thought was not only really funny and oddly poignant, but I thought it dealt with a lot of really, sort of creepy issues that we don't like discussing, but he does it in a way in which I feel like they all are kind of front and center. He doesn't shy away from anything. And, the movie stylistically is a cross between Woody Allen's Manhattan, which I think is quite conscious.
Nod or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's also got a touch of kind of Curb Your Enthusiasm, in terms of the comic timing within scenes. Mm-hmm. It's played fairly deadpan, nobody sort of going over the top. So that's a movie I really liked a lot. And then Aaron Sorkin's movie, the one that Molly's Game, is really good. It's tour de force performance. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of an adrenaline trip. The sort of thing that stylistically you would expect from a Scorsese film. But one of the most interesting things about it is that the central character is a woman, which I don't think we'd ever seen in a Scorsese film.
Not since Barbara Hershey played Mary Magdalene or whatever. Yeah. No, you're right. I can't recall.
Some people have criticized it for there being too much dialogue and or too much voiceover. And, that's like saying, Woody Allen's films have too many jokes or... it's like that's who Aaron Sorkin is. He's a dialogue. I mean, he's somebody who trades in dialogue, and he's fucking brilliant at it. So, why complain about it? Just absorb it and enjoy it.
But this is his first directorial
effort,
right? Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for the. Do you get to the New York Film Festival at all?
I'll be trying to catch up on whatever I missed in Toronto. And there's.
Do you go to the public screenings, or do you go to the
typically
PNIs?
I go to the press and industry screenings.
Yeah. I went to my first yesterday. Well, that was the first day.
Yeah,
but I did go see this the Joan Didion documentary by Griffin Dunn, and I can tell you it's really good, moving, and just beautiful. It's really beautiful. You know, so there's a bunch I'm looking forward to seeing. I'm about to launch my first Kickstarter ever because I, you know, have crappy equipment next time, and I'll try to build a real studio type of, among other things. And so I mentioned only because I expected that I was going to launch it already. So I said, I can't go to TIFF this year. And now, you know, I guess I could have gone, but I was collecting rewards and all that stuff. So wish me luck anyway. Well, let's wind down because I know it's already been like an hour, I think, and I wasn't even...
I can't even imagine anybody listening to this whole thing.
Well, as I mentioned, I think I mentioned, right? A large percentage, I think, of people that do listen to my show are interested in film on obviously this level. It's a niche show. I'm not kidding myself. Where, you know... This is, but I do. You'd be surprised. I think they'll be great.
Well, I'll be interested in seeing the metrics.
And the end of the, and in the end, you know, it's also for me because I'm interested. You know, and I'm very interested. And it also, I hopefully will one day work as an archive of some sort too. Even though it's not like we talked to the degree which, you know, maybe we could have about your past. So maybe. We'll pick it up, part two at some point. But I am interested in, you know, certain periods of time, obviously, in the timeline of independent film. So this sort of tries to, over time, you know, the conversation we're having, in other words, is part of a larger web of...
Understood.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I look forward to your finishing this documentary, you know, and...
Me too.
Yeah. How long have you been? 2 years?
That's been 2 years, yeah.
2 years, all right, that's... You know, even for one that's a subject that you know the beginning and end to, that's not so bad. The problem is when you don't know the end and then,
I know.
Yeah.
Well, in this case, I don't know the middle.
I see.
The fact is a lot of the history is stuff that I frankly didn't know. And the movie is structured as kind of a mystery where I'm in it and I'm actually trying to uncover what the reality was.
In your conversations?
Yeah.
I see. So it's an investigation of sorts, too.
Of sorts, yes.
I see. Interesting.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Ira. It's really nice to meet you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.